Welcome back to Doctors and Litigation, the L Word. This is Season 2, Episode 5. When you read headlines about multi-million dollar verdicts against physicians or APPs, it's unsettling on many fronts. If you're already a defendant, it upsets your stomach for obvious reasons. If you haven't been named yet, it just creates fear and anxiety around what could happen if you have a bad outcome in the future, and that's just another pour into that whole cup of burnout and thoughts about leaving medicine. I certainly remember the feeling of finding out the plaintiff's attorneys were looking for damages in the 20-something million dollar range, and that was in the early 2000s. So one, I felt panic, and two, just knowing that a verdict that size would be covered in the news and that I would be mentioned by name and shamed publicly, and it was just really almost too much to bear. And I had seen those headlines before about other doctors, and I had learned that most cases that went to trial had good care behind them, and so when I read those stories, that made me feel even worse, and definitely it took a toll on my mental health. Today, let's have an open conversation about the nuclear or aberration verdict. Has there been an increasing trend? Yes. But probably not to the degree over which we are panicking. Part of the problem is the news coverage of these cases and their headlines and the sensationalizing of these numbers, which jury pools do see and perhaps are coming to see it as just the way things are done. I mean, we don't bat an eye at a CEO raking in tens of millions of dollars a year, and so maybe that's just what happens in these cases. What the news doesn't give as much attention to is what comes afterwards, where that number eventually lands, what happens on appeal. And one thing that really makes me mad is that they almost never cover when the doctors win at trial. That would be a headline I'd like to see. Other theories abound as to where these numbers are coming from. Some say that it shows the public's bias against corporations, and often companies are involved as a co-defendant in litigation with the doctor. Some blame plaintiff's attorney tactics that make the jury feel like a large award is necessary to send a message and somehow help fix things like a broken healthcare system or greedy corporations. They make it about much more than this one case. They make it about public safety and changing things that the jury doesn't like about society. And everybody is angry with healthcare right now. Patients don't have the same relationships with their doctors as they used to. Also, there are experts who will testify to exorbitant numbers for how much it costs to care for someone with medical needs, and the jury may have this feeling of, well, the insurance company has money and this family needs it, and that can also impact these outcomes. And remember that we see these outcomes largely in states where there is no tort reform or tort reform has been overturned. Where you live, the malpractice climate will absolutely influence the risk involved. And if you're planning a move or just starting out in practice, factor that into your calculus. Don't let it run your life, but knowledge is always better than ignorance. So speaking of knowledge, today to help us with some knowledge around this topic, I have a guest, defense attorney Dusty Otwell, who is the chief risk officer for U.S. Acute Care Solutions. He has been practicing medical malpractice defense for over 20 years. He's here to shed some light and give us some reassurance. Dusty, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to talk about this topic, nuclear verdicts, which we were just saying before we got started that that's a term that certainly us as physicians makes us afraid. I mean, it's a terribly terrifying thought. And you were like, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Always appreciate collaborating with you, Geeta. But I'm a lawyer and I'm a medical malpractice lawyer. So I enjoy handling the greatest challenging cases. Now, I understand that there's a lot of fear that instills into my defendants, and I'm certainly sensitive to that. And I really enjoy being able to, you know, remove some of these cases from my defendants, and that brings a lot of catharsis to them. But I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about nuclear verdicts, and I'm hoping we can clear some of that up today.
So let us start from the beginning. So, okay, what is this nuclear verdict business? So my understanding is, and it seems like it's been more of a problem in maybe the past decade, but the insurance industry in general, not just in malpractice, has been struggling with this growing concern of these so-called nuclear verdicts. They're not just normal, ordinary legal outcomes. They are verdicts that are these really significantly high jury awards that really exceed what the insurance company had thought. You know, gosh, if we lose at trial, it might cost us X amount of money. And then the jury comes back with this number that's like 10 times that, or just tens upon hundreds of millions of dollars. And these are the cases that make the news and completely strike fear into the heart of a physician who's entering into litigation, especially if the case is centered around something really serious, like a patient death, or, you know, let's say a baby who was born with anoxic injuries or things like that. Like, these are really tough cases already for the physician who is grappling with this terrible adverse event that's happened. And now they hear this term nuclear verdict.
I think we've done a little bit of a disservice to physicians and APPs with that term nuclear verdict. I mean, it implies just a unmitigated disaster that, you know, nobody saw coming and there's no defense against it. And that's just not accurate. I think really the most descriptive term of these types of cases, you actually touched on it, is that it exceeds what we thought. And to me, aberration verdict is the best term that I find really describes the category of cases that to me are from $5 million to $25 million. And the key to fitting into that category is that in the past, these cases might have been worth something. And now, surprise, we got hit for a lot more than that. And we did not see it coming. And that comes from estimations based on precedent in that jurisdiction. And then like, oh my gosh, here we are. It's a $7 million verdict. That aberration, inability to forecast that coming, that to me is what I see as a nuclear or runaway jury verdict or aberration verdict. And those are the ones I'm most concerned about. And I think your listeners should be most sensitive to.
It hurts on two counts, right? Because if you're going to trial, you typically think that your care is defensible and hopefully your defendant is a good witness. And you think that there's a decent chance that you're going to win this thing. And then not only do you not win, but then there's this aberration verdict. It's a surprise on all counts, it seems like. Adds insult to injury.
Your listeners, I think broadly, physicians and APPs can better prepare themselves by kind of understanding the reality of the situation. You said a word that means a lot to me, and it's defensible. I thought my care was defensible. Well, in 1995...
Oh, I forget. You hate this word, defensible.
That mattered on cases that we defended when I was in high school. But now, juries and plaintiff attorneys are playing a different game. And so, yes, you might think you didn't do anything wrong. That could absolutely be true. But the way that these cases really go south and we end up with these aberration verdicts is the plaintiffs come in with arguments designed to make you look like a villain, designed to make the jury angry. You know, when people get angry, logic doesn't matter anymore. Standard of care can be relatively insignificant compared to, I'm angry, I don't like that doctor, I like this plaintiff, and I'm going to give him a lot of money. So I think that, you know, if you really prepare yourself for what these cases are really about, and sometimes they're not really about the care, they're about emotion, they're about money, they're about human beings, then I think you can approach the case in a more effective manner and maybe avoid the aberration verdict, but at least understand what you're getting into so you don't have that real just extreme surprise factor when the jury comes back against you.
I think it's known as a reptile strategy. That's the name that I've heard used for when plaintiffs' attorneys are trying to get the jury to make decisions not based on the facts of care in this particular case, but really their anger at society, their anger at the corporation, and their anger with the medical system, their anger at the man, and to pour all of that into this verdict to send a message.
Correct.
Is that a proper understanding of this strategy, or what is a reptile strategy? What does that mean?
The reptile theory has been around for a long time, and it's really kind of putting jurors in a position where the plaintiff is calling upon them to protect society, to protect the themselves. This doctor is unsafe. They're dangerous. And it's on you to fix this for society and for yourself. These tactics have really evolved. And now it's not so much about kind of keeping your community safe. It's about punishment. It's about anger. And I think this has really kind of evolved along with our culture in the past 5 to 10 years. And plaintiffs have just gotten better and better at tapping into kind of the discontent and the anger of your average juror, your average American. They're really evolving this reptile theory where they're asking the jurors to kind of tap into their anger at this situation, at this doctor, more likely at this hospital, and send a message and punish them so they can never do this again.
I want to kind of think about this in three ways. First, I want to ask you about, from the insurance perspective, from the insurer's perspective, what happens when there is an excess verdict like this? How often does it actually fall on the physician to be able to come up with tens of millions of dollars? Because most of us don't have that. How often is the insurer the one who has to pay tens of millions of dollars, and how do they afford that? And then what are the repercussions of an aberration verdict in that way?
That's a great question, because these news headlines you see of so-and-so verdict against such-and-such clinician or hospital, when there's a verdict, I like to say it's halftime. And the game is not over, and we've still got a long way to go. So it gets complicated. And I can't say that in every case, this is what's going to happen. But in general terms, a negotiation begins once the verdict comes down. That negotiation is really informed by, what are our avenues of appeal? You know, can we move for a new trial? Is there good grounds to appeal the verdict and when? Okay, so now maybe we have some leverage and we can potentially appeal the case. Now we go to the plaintiff attorney and say, okay, good for you. You got a $50 million verdict. Our insurance limits are $1 million. The doctor has a house that you can't get to. So how about let's make a deal, or we're going to appeal this and you're going to be tied up in appeals for the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, and you're not going to get any money until that's all over. So we start a negotiation with the plaintiff attorney. Often those negotiations are successful. So a secret under a lot of these headlines that you see is that sometime after those headlines, a negotiated solution was struck between maybe the insurance company, maybe the hospital, and the plaintiff attorney to close the matter without going to a long appeals process.
How often does it happen that the physician is held responsible for that kind of money?
I specifically want to address that. So I've been doing this a long time. I have seen one case where a plaintiff attorney pursued a physician personally for a verdict. It was out west. It wasn't my defendant. It was a surgeon. And I mean, this guy was the surgeon out west. He was extremely rich. I mean, think, you know, those surgeons you hear about operating on baseball players. Think him times 10. Okay, this guy was extremely successful. And so the plaintiff attorney kind of wanted to set an example of, you know, if you're a big time surgeon, I'm going to come after you. I don't know where that ended. And I know that surgeon still lives in his house and still does fine. I have dealt with literally thousands of cases, and I've seen one case where a plaintiff attorney tried to go against an individual physician, and I have never seen a plaintiff attorney try to go against a ER or acute care physician. I've just never seen it.
I think we know the stories of when people are threatened with it. It's certainly used as a bargaining chip more and more, certainly in these plaintiff-friendly states. I was speaking to someone in Illinois recently where that was used as a tactic. There's an episode on the podcast that people have been following all along, episode 3, which actually scares a lot of people. In retrospect, I recognize that it is a frightening episode, but it is something that did happen where the threat of that is used explicitly to encourage a physician to want to settle. It is much rarer, certainly, and I've been talking to a lot of people for a long time. It would be an aberration. We'll use that word. It would be an aberration, from my understanding, for any sort of large payment like that to wind up eventually really in the hands of the physician. It is not impossible, but it is absolutely not the norm and not something that I think should keep people awake at night. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I understand the fear because, I mean, that's a real possibility. Legally, they could try to get your personal assets. Now, in many states, your home, kind of your close assets, your retirement is protected. It depends on where you are. So let's say a plaintiff attorney threatens, you know, they send me a letter and they're trying to scare us to settle. Put yourself in the shoes of the plaintiff attorney. Okay, I know that's hard to think about being that kind of person, but I know many plaintiff attorneys and I think I kind of understand how they think. Let's say they get a $25 million verdict. Let's say in this case, you have $1 million in insurance. Let's say the hospital was involved. Let's say some other co-defendants are involved. And so there's maybe several million dollars in insurance proceeds that they can try to collect. Do you think the plaintiff attorney is going to spend legal effort and bandwidth, capital, to try to get your personal assets? Maybe your net worth is $5 million, and maybe they can get some small portion of that at the end of the day. Do you really think they're going to go through the effort, the bad publicity, to try to get $750,000 from you? Plaintiff attorneys are in this for the maximum reimbursement with the least amount of effort. That's one thing I've learned about them, and that makes sense. But put into that perspective, going against an individual physician, probably a sympathetic physician, and they're going to look pretty bad if they're trying to take their assets, it's just not a likely outcome. They're much more likely to go after the insurance companies, the corporations, the hospitals, than go after any individual.
I mean, well, the truth is, I mean, you can't get blood from a stone, right? And I think, you know, there are going to be doctors listening that were like, $5 million. But the truth is, like, you know, where is that money going to come from? Like, when I was first named, I was still in debt, right? I was like, where are they going to get $28 million from? Like, there's no $28 million. It's not coming. That was the initial demand in my case. I was like, that didn't make me feel any better. It was more of a panic. Like, where am I going to get $28 million? Like, that was the fear. Like, oh my God, I'm going to be working for these people for the rest of my life. Like, this is crazy. So not an event that happens often. After any sort of aberration verdict, there is going to be some other kind of negotiation that takes place that's going to bring this into the realm of something more reasonable. Usually, this will be hopefully policy limits, or there might be an appeal. You know, I think what you said is kind of true in terms of plaintiff's attorneys wanting the maximum amount of reimbursement for the least amount of effort. And I think that explains why the pressure for the physician to want to settle up front, you know, it makes sense for them to turn that screw. Because if someone says, uncle, here's a check, that was pretty easy.
Correct. So that's where I think you'll see the topic of excess liability on an individual physician or APP come up the most. It's that plaintiff attorneys are trying to use that for leverage to force a settlement. There could be cases, and this is becoming more common, of plaintiff attorneys, they think their odds are so good of a high verdict from a jury that they won't settle. They won't make a demand. They won't entertain an offer. That's another area where, you know, we're kind of seeing these aberration or nuclear verdicts come into play of plaintiff attorneys who just think their odds are so great, they're going for it. But more likely, it's a settlement tactic.
Well, what's going to matter in that case where the plaintiff is insistent that you're going to trial? To my mind, it is going to be, can your defendant be a superstar witness?
That is a huge part of it. I mean, getting into the tactics of defending a multi-million-dollar potential verdict trial, I mean, I love that stuff. It is difficult, it's challenging, and you have to really evolve the way you defend your cases if you're going to handle a case like that. It's about your preparation as a witness. It's about the defense attorneys having a plan to diffuse the anger of the jurors. It's about them having a plan to mitigate the potential damages that you and the group and the hospital are all exposed to. If we're getting into the area of we might take this to trial or we might be forced to take this to trial, we really have to step up our game to give ourselves the best chances of winning or at least mitigating the potential verdict that a jury returns.
So now let's back up. I was saying there were these three buckets that I wanted to talk about. Now I want to ask about how the defense industry has had to adapt with this increasing, looming threat of nuclear verdicts. Like, what is changing in the way that you defend doctors and prepare cases with that in mind?
And I say this as a proud member of the defense bar, largely we haven't.
Okay.
Largely we have not evolved. And that is why the plaintiff attorneys are eating our lunch in a lot of these cases. Now, having said that, there are some groups and, you know, proactive professionals, I like to think of myself, who are trying to push the envelope and move us forward in terms of how we defend these cases. American Legal Connections, you spoke with me during the pandemic. That's a good group, really kind of pushing us forward into the 21st century on how we defend these cases. Having said that, there's about two or three major differences we have to bring to the table if we're defending a nuclear case. In these cases, the basics that you've heard of before, standard of care, cause, and damages, that's table stakes. You know, you got to have that ready to go. And if that's all you got, good luck. So on top of your foundation of kind of the basic traditional argument of we did it right and we didn't cause this outcome, you now have to really get into kind of the emotional realm of the jury's potential reaction. How are we going to tell them a story that they like better than what the plaintiff is going to tell them? Or at least, how do we diffuse their anger so that they don't run away from us? So starting with really kind of going jury-centric with how we approach these cases, that's, to me, the number one thing you need to do when you're dealing with a potential, you know, aberration case. And then two, you got to think about and talk about money. I know we don't like to do that. The old advice is, don't talk to the jury about potential damages because it makes you look guilty. That does not work anymore. If you don't talk to the jury about money, the plaintiff's going to talk to them about money, and that's the only number they're going to hear. So if you're lucky, they'll give you half of that. So you need to be going up there talking about, you know, here's a reasonable amount of damages, despite the plaintiff telling you that they really need $150 million. That's ridiculous. What would really help them is, you know, 5 to 7, something like that.
That is interesting to me because I can see the logic of saying like, oh, if you say like, well, a reasonable amount of money would be $5 million for this. It does sound to me like you're saying like, yeah, this was sort of on us, but we think that less amount of money would be corrective in this situation. That's a tough one for me.
Absolutely. That's why you got to hire the professionals who really know what they're doing, because it is a delicate line you got to walk where you've got to post a robust defense. We didn't do anything wrong. We didn't cause this. And you know what else? The amount of damages they're asking you to give them is so ridiculous that it should be an insult to you and your reasonableness, jury. Because a reasonable amount of damages to take care of them for the rest of their life would be $5 million. So their entire case is ridiculous. And then it kind of feeds into your overall argument of we didn't do anything wrong. We didn't cause this outcome. And even if you find against us, a reasonable amount is far less than what they're asking for.
All right. So that was, I wanted to know about the attorney perspective on this. And now the last perspective I want to ask you about is my whole lens is about preparing physician defendants. I think that for a long time, we've left that to everybody else to sort of teach us as the case goes along. A couple of weeks before deposition, you get a little preparation. A month before trial, someone starts saying like, we better pay attention to your case. Like, let's get the defendant ready. And I work with the physician who, you know, the insurer or the attorney will call and say like, trial's next month and this person's not ready. And it's a big case. So can you do what you can? And my whole thing is like, no, like that's too late. That is too late. So what do you want to say to the physician defendant in terms of how to mentally prepare themselves? They're not dummies. They're pretty smart. They know when there's a case that they feel the weight of it. You know, if there's someone who died or again, like, you know, a baby that had a bad outcome, like that person is feeling the weight of that. I'm going to use the word. If they feel like their care was defensible, they feel like they did everything right, but they know that the stakes are really high. What advice do you have for them in terms of keeping their perspective about this and how do they want to show up?
That scenario you described drives me up the wall, where you have a defense team who's starting to take it seriously a month before a trial. That is a never event to me. We can't do that anymore with the kind of verdict risks that we're facing in this industry. So, I mean, it's my profession. It's, you know, folks like me at groups that are following these cases that are really kind of pushing our insurance carriers and our defense teams to find these cases early that have a potential high risk and work them up appropriately and get the clinicians ready earlier than a month before trial. I mean, a month before trial, to me, the thing's over. We need to be realizing that, I mean, a month after we get the case, not a month before trial. But what can the physicians and APPs do? I think that they should feel empowered. They are one of the most powerful players in this whole game. I mean, the outside attorney representing the clinician, he or she has a fiduciary obligation to that APP. They can get sued if they don't do right by you. And you would bring the case. So understand that you are a powerful player and that you should speak up. So one thing I want you to do is demand financial risk estimates. Attorneys don't like doing that because they haven't had to do it in the past because we've been talking about lower risks. But now I think they have to do it.
All right. What is a financial risk estimate? Before we ask for it, we need to know what it is.
Okay. You got me going. So I need to slow down. I'm getting excited. It's just a guess. It's an educated guess around what is the verdict risk in this case. And when attorneys kind of balk at giving you that estimation, I say to them, you are the number one person on earth who can give an estimation of what the verdict risk is in this case. So just pick a number that if we were gambling, you might bet high or you might bet low, kind of on a 50-50 chance level. So just give me your best guess. What is the verdict risk on this case? If I were a physician or APP, I would be demanding that from my defense attorney early in the case.
And now what am I going to do with that information besides be freaked out?
Accept the reality of the risk of your case. So now, if they tell you, you know, this is a $250,000 case, they only had a one-day stay in the hospital, that's important information for you. I'm not saying don't worry about the case and don't prepare. But if they say, you know, this could be a $25 million case, you say, okay, what are we going to do about it? How are you going to get me ready, you know, to be a rock star? So that really should inform kind of their plan. That's your next question is, okay, what's the plan? What's the long-term plan to protect me from that possible outcome? And yes, then that gets into, you know, we're going to hire a professional outfit to get you ready to testify. You know, we're going to get our own damages model. We're going to do all these things that are going to better prepare you and mitigate the risk. And that all comes to me from that initial estimation of what the verdict risk is in the case.
So it's almost like asking them that question and getting that number can really sort of force a conversation of like, okay, if that's the risk, like, what are you going to do to get me ready now? And do you really think that just a Zoom 30 minutes, 2 weeks before my deposition is adequate?
And it's not that I don't think insurance companies and defense attorneys are, you know, hiding this from physicians for malevolent reasons. I think they understandably are like, well, let's not freak him or her out. Let's let this play out. And everybody's just kind of dancing around what they know to be the truth of this is a dangerous case. So if a physician comes out and says, hey, I can handle it. You know, I listened to that podcast. Tell me what we're really dealing with here. Then you get the truth out in the open and then you can make a more effective plan if you do have a potentially big case.
1,000%. Arguing with reality is not going to get you very far. And hiding from reality is not going to get you very far. So actually, I love that. You mentioned you sort of in quick fashion, the options that are available to people for witness preparation or for getting themselves ready. Like what are some of the tools that attorneys and insurers use in high value cases like this to make sure that their witnesses are ready?
Sure. There's a spectrum. So in a high value case, you might be spending some money on a professional witness preparation company. There's several of them. They really kind of come at it from a emotional, psychological perspective, not so much a legal perspective, which is great. Because when I've seen a witness really blow it, it's not because he or she wasn't smart and didn't know the topic intellectually. It's because their fight or flight response kicked in and they couldn't handle it.
What about mock trials?
Oh, yes. So I used to use mock trials and it was kind of like, people would come in on a Saturday and eat pizza and give us a mock verdict. I've moved to these jury consultants that conduct online or phone surveys in the potential jurisdiction. And what that does is I think it gives me a better feel on kind of the pulse of the jurisdiction and how they might respond to my plaintiff. it's a little fancier. Maybe it's a little more expensive, but they can return really kind of a data report with a spectrum of potential outcomes on your case that I think provides valuable input. All that is to say, mock trials are good too. And I think using resources like that just gives you more information so you can make a better decision about how to defend or settle, you know, mitigate the risk in your case. I use them. I love them.
Any last words for us before we wrap things up?
I always encourage clinicians to keep it in perspective. 2/3 of the cases out there are worth well under $1 million. Maybe 5 to 10% of the cases out there are the ones that could potentially go over $1 million. At the end of the day, these cases are somewhat rare, but if it motivates you to do even more for your patients, to, you know, use those resources and tools to mitigate the rare bad outcomes, hey, great. Just try not to worry too much about these cases because they still are quite rare.
Thank you so much, Dusty, for your expertise. It's always fun talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed talking to you. I'm always happy to help.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much to Dusty Otwell. I hope that was helpful in terms of giving you some perspective on these nuclear or aberration verdicts. It's probably a topic we'll revisit at some point and certainly will be an ongoing topic of discussion among attorneys and malpractice insurers. But to my physicians and providers listening, know that you have more agency than you think you do. Knowing the right questions to ask your attorney and getting the skills and mindset preparation you need to be the best witness possible is key. And when we come back next month, we're going to be shining a spotlight on tips to help you be a better communicator under pressure. See you then.